Hello, this is Tracy Hales Bass with Right on Four Corners. Today I have the pleasure to talk with Pam Houston and Amy Irvine about their new book, Airmail, Letters of Politics, Pandemics, and Place. Hi, Pam and Amy.
Hi there. So
you finally met face-to-face.
We did. We met in early July after the book had been sent off to the publisher and the press, and we finally got to meet on a beautiful evening in Santa Fe. Both happened to go down there for different reasons. Pam brought over cheeseburgers and milkshakes for my daughter and me. My daughter was there getting acquainted with her new service dog, and the dog was having a sleepover. So all four of us sat out on the porch, and finally the dog and the daughter went to bed, and we just kept talking as though we'd known each other forever, because it did feel like that at that point.
Now, this was put together by Orion's editor.
That was the initiating idea.
Okay.
Sumanth Prabhakar, the editor of Orion, had called Amy and asked her to write just a few letters, 3,000 words total, I think, as part of a series they were doing called Together Apart, where two writers would write to each other. And he asked her who she would like to write to, and even though we had never met, we did know each other's work and each other's books, and we were Facebook friends, and we had had a little exchange that morning on Facebook, so that made Amy think of me, and I said yes, and we were off and running. Now, that was just the initial letters, but once we got finished writing those early letters, we realized very quickly that, first of all, we had a lot more to say to each other, and that we were forming a friendship and a sisterhood, and we were talking each other into direct political action, and we were consoling each other when we had bad and scary days, and so we just decided to keep writing after that.
You know, the second part of that story about how the book came about was that we kept writing, still with no intention of it becoming a book, letters for one another, and about 25,000 words into it, we realized maybe we had something that we should share with the world at large to chronicle these times. And that was when we approached Tory House Press. It's a group of intrepid women who never say no to the most outlandish ideas. They had published my last book and had said yes to a whole bunch of things that anybody else in publishing would say there's no way, like the timeline and the various other things. So I said to Pam, and she said, well, this would be great to turn into a book, but we decided it needed to come out before the election, that it was really a galvanizing tool as much as anything. And as Pam said, you know, nobody in New York could turn it out in time if they even wanted it, because it is very much a book that speaks to the West and the issues that we're struggling with out here, in particular these big wild landscapes that we all love so much and the things that threaten them directly right now, which not the least of which are these huge wildfires and, of course, the drought that has helped create those fires. And so we took it to the Tory House Press, and the first thing he said was, you know, there's no way. We're in an election year. We're in the middle of a pandemic. There's no budget. Like, we can't. And we said, well, just look at these letters. And they said, oh, wow, yeah, we need to publish this. And so it was just a few months. We literally edited the book in just days. We just 2 months worth of editing in a very, very short period of time, back and forth all night on the phone. The adventure continued into that phase.
So it started out kind of as an isolation communication because of the COVID pandemic, but you cover so much more. One thing is the pandemic of misogyny.
Right. Yes. It's true. I mean, and of course these things are not unrelated. The story about the Wuhan market is true. You know, a bunch of very, very, very rich men in China trying to impress other very, very rich men by serving pangolin, you know, and the West is on fire because the greed of the oil company CEOs. And we're, I think a lot of women are tired of being silent. I think one of the things Amy and I have been talking about a lot in our together time out on tour is just remaking the myth of the American West. If you think about the language, the misogynistic language of the conquer, the rape, the pillage, the extract, frack her till she blows, you know, the language we talk about taming the American West. And if you try to take those words out of your vocabulary and start using a more feminized language to talk about the West, you know, mm-hmm. nurture, care for, protect, defend, you know, mm-hmm. it changes everything about how we even look at the West. So very quickly, you know, in our letters, we wrote to this place of understanding, which, you know, of course we both had, but it's still good to articulate it, that the rape and pillage of Mother Earth is not unlike the rape and pillage of women, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, all these subjects are not unrelated.
And it's amazing how in the letters you quickly come to a common mind.
Yes, I think we were always mm-hmm. common mind. It was funny because we actually had it seems like men really love it when women have the cat fight, but we... We were sort of done with that narrative. We were very much writing from a place of solidarity, standing on a very common ground, which is this very earth that takes care of us. And so there was very little to argue about or feel tense about, except for the things that were happening outside of the friendship and outside of the letters. And that was more than enough drama for us.
About in the middle of it, the tempers, not at each other, but at the situation, really rear up. And you share those, but you also console each other.
Yeah, we decided early that we had to take turns having bad days. Or else it just came naturally that way. There was one day I tried to catch a cooking knife on the way down and sliced my hand, and I was afraid to go to the doctor because no one in my county wears masks. And then another day when I realized I had left my passport in California, which Amy writes a beautiful letter where she can't breathe and the pollen and the smoke, and she's scared about getting nebulizers because they were in short supply mm-hmm. that her daughter and she both need. And she writes a beautiful letter where everything is crashing down on her. And, you know, I do think we sort of took turns, you know. It's always easier to say to someone else, no, come on, we can do it, you know, find your strength, than it is to say that to ourselves. I think that was a huge part of the letters. I mean, I can't express enough how determined we were to write those letters long before we ever thought there was a book. I mean, there was no thought, oh, we're doing this, I mean, not, you know, to make a book or to sell a book, but also not even to keep track. We were doing it because talking to another person who understood our love of the land and who also understood that very thing you mentioned, that the dismantling of the Clean Air Act feels essentially the same to us, because we have both been loved and healed and nurtured by the land, you know, by the clean air and water, by these mountains that are on fire right now. You know, we understood each other so deeply and intrinsically and intuitively, like right from the start. And it was just having the other to affirm back to us what we were scared about, what we were fighting for, what we were determined to fight for in the future. And, I mean, I can't even express how important that was, separate from anything, like separate mm-hmm. from any small impact we might have on the election, or separate from having another book in the world, which, of course, is always a good thing, you mm-hmm. know, a pleasurable thing, or from meeting our obligation to Orion. Separate from all of that, we were literally forging a sustaining sisterhood in a time when it seemed like the men in charge were coming at every angle to destroy us.
We really, along with all the women at Torrey House Press who had our back on this, we just felt it was really important to get out and talk to other women in particular, but also the good men who were out there that we have at our side, our husbands included, and just sort of help people feel some solidarity and inspiration when, in a time when I think the pandemic could not have come at a worse time in this election year and with the rest of the horrific news cycle. It really served to divide and almost conquer us. And I know a lot of people felt so overwhelmed and hopeless. And so we braved all that and went out on this tour. And we will get back to the letters, but We had a mission to accomplish
right.
before that, but we will keep writing because, of course, there's more still happening, and like all the ways that I think we're all feeling very unsure of the election and everybody getting to vote fairly and squarely and on time and all that. we know that the world, regardless of all that, we then have messes to clean up, the way we've ceased to trust one another, the way we confront these fires and this drought. I mean, we really aren't going back to business as usual, not right. with the kind of climate impact we're seeing at this time.
Another thing that you really have in common is your discussions on animals.
Yeah, I mean, I think animals are hugely important in our lives, both real animals, of course, mm-hmm. and also animals as metaphors and animals as teachers. My animals are my teachers in the waking world constantly. I have dogs and horses and sheep, Icelandic sheep and chicken and cat, and, you know, I look to them all the time. And I will say, sort of not exactly apropos of this conversation, but one real silver lining of COVID is that I have been able, really for the first time in my working life, to give my animals the attention they deserve. I've been able to sort of show up for them in this mm-hmm. time the way they always show up for me when I breeze home for 7 days and then I'm out for 14 days and I'm home for 7 days. You know, there's been a real sweetness and a real connection in being with my animals and giving them the kind of care. There's nothing quite like, you know, mom being home,
right.
caring for you every day. And so that's been a really lovely thing about the pandemic, is just constant and consistent care. They're a real salvation, and mm-hmm. they make me smile on days when I feel like I can't get my head up off the floor, you know?
Right, and I do think it's a way we've been severed from our relationship with the earth and with our own physical bodies. Certainly technology and our crazy world that we've constructed that doesn't leave a lot of time for leisure, and there's more like the frenetic hour on the Stairmaster or on the yoga mat. But and for some people, none of that, because they don't have the luxury and the privilege of getting an hour of exercise during the day. So there's a way that I think our relationships with animals, when you bring them back into sharp focus, they require us to slow down, and they require us to be in our physical body and aware and engaged with the physical elements around us. And maybe perhaps the worst thing to come out of the pandemic and the being at home is the way we've spent more and more time online and more time trying to distract ourselves, be it shopping online or watching Netflix, the latest series on Netflix. Not of all of which is that. And in many ways, the internet has served as an amazing tool to galvanize people and turn people out for protests and to perpetuate, remind people of the rights that are still inalienably ours, although it's forgotten far too often. So, yeah, I think whether you're talking about the pangolins in China or you're talking about the factory farms in America, you know, we are so severed from the reality of animals mm-hmm. and the mythology and the, you know, that native communities would maybe refer to them in a medicine that they bring, be it in dreams or in stories. We've also sort of fallen away from that.
I think that the story you have in here of the elk who was trapped in the mm-hmm. fence.
My husband and I were driving home from a hike. We actually watched about 200 elk cross the fence and stayed way, way far away, more than a mile away, watching them jump the fence. And then when we got up close, we saw that one cow had gotten caught, and we tried very hard to get her out with both of us pulling on the wire, but it was just too tight. She was like triple wrapped. And so we raced home to get wire cutters. I mean, raced home. It was about a 6 mile drive to get home. And the weird thing was we could see where she was, because we had to go down the river a little bit and then come up the river a little bit to get to our house. And we raced back there. And the whole time I was going, I was thinking, you know, she's everything. Like, if I can't even save this elk, like, I can't save all the people who are dying of COVID.
Right.
I can't save all the animals that are burning in the forest fires. We can't save the Clean Air Act or the Clean Water Act or the wolves and the bears in their dens in Alaska. Like,
right.
It was just all piling up on me. I thought, we have got to save this elk cow. And we got back, you know, in about, whatever, 10 or 12 minutes, and she was gone. And we didn't see a car over there attending to her. So I think there must have been, you know, maybe in the moment when we ran into the garage to get the wire cutters. But anyway, there was no trace of her. And I walked the whole fence line, and I thought, God, was she a magic elk? Was she a spirit elk?
Right.
Did she she, I have no idea who she was. But in any case, either a cowboy who's better at fences than we were, stop and pull them apart. You know, we couldn't do it. Or she somehow kicked out herself, or she was a messenger, you know.
Right.
I don't know. But in any case, she did not die in that fence.
So airmail, letters of politics, pandemics, and place. I thought it was very interesting that you are on either side of the Continental Divide, but share so many of the same place relationships, including the fires that are pretty much right between you.
Indeed. We still every day sort of marvel in our conversations about how we did not meet before now. I mean, we have, many of the same readership. We have many of the same friends. We've worked and adventured in so many of the same places that it's just really strange. And we keep thinking, well, maybe we were just supposed to store it all up for now, for this moment, when the friendship can really catch fire in a way that the way the best relationships in the world do, that they spread, you know, beyond the two people and make other things happen. And maybe that sounds a little bit grandiose, but it all felt a little like the elf, like it became everything in so many ways on so many levels. And it's still extraordinary to know that we've both been living on either side of the Continental Divide and living these parallel lives and only this year learning about him. But boy, what a year to find a good friend. And to not be it would have been easy to just have our sessions be sort of bitch fests where we're complaining about everything in maybe a more selfish or shallow kind of way, but even though the letters for Orion that began the letter writing are somewhat romantic and a little naive about the pandemic, I mean, early on we were thinking, it's great, we have our pantry stocked, and we both have the luxury of working at home, and we both have the luxury of having good internet, and we both have the luxury of stepping outside our door when we're done working and going out to walk on these millions of acres of incredible pristine public land, some of the most beautiful in the West. But very quickly, you know, we were always painfully aware of that privilege, just the privilege of the time to write these letters and the ability to get them to one another across the divide, knowing that other people were not faring so well. But, of course, that changed very quickly as death knell rose, as we saw things like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act being dismantled. We saw the national monuments that we love so much being gutted. And, you know, both of us love rural areas and care very much about the families that produce food in these regions for us. I feel like we're on our own, and it became all the more reason to keep writing, was that it feels like we just now have to take care of one another and take care of these resources, because they're the people in power really at this moment couldn't care less about them.
Talked about meeting up on the divide, like walking to meet as opposed to driving, which we have now done. But walking would be much shorter. We couldn't do it right now, literally, because there is a fire. The ice fire is right between us, and all those trails are closed and blocked. So maybe if this fire season ever ends, we can do that next year.
Literally, while we were on this book tour, we were dodging all the big fires up in northern Colorado, and they were literally closing roads behind us, and we were joking about it being the Armageddon book tour, because we were literally standing outside in howling wind under this very scary, dark sky, everybody bundled up and wearing their masks in somebody's driveway, and we're signing their book, ash raining down on the pages.
Well, that's an apocalyptic scene.
It was intense. I mean, we're both really tired because there was just so much more to negotiate and worry about going into each community. Each community had sort of its own COVID culture about what was safe and what wasn't. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, like wherever we were staying, you know, what the rules were, could you eat the food? Could you? It was just all very taxing in a way that book tour is already taxing.
Right.
Was like a whole extra layer that's
exactly
pretty intense.
They, that place where we were reading was in Granby, Colorado, and they're now on standby to evacuate from the troublesome fun.
So you share a common friend in Craig Childs.
Yes, we do. And it was Craig who introduced me to Amy's work. Craig called me and said, there's this book, Desert Cabal. I think you'd really like it. I can't believe you guys don't know each other. You know, would you consider reading it and writing a blurb for the cover. And I read it, but it was as if she was inside my head, you know, except she was saying it better than I had ever, either out loud or to myself. It was, you know, I saw her passion and her irreverence toward, you know, the normal way of doing things, even inside environmental movements, and just the basic message of Desert Cabal, which is that we can't have Desert Solitaire anymore. We gave that up because of all of us out there loving the wilderness at the same time, some of us on four-wheelers and razors and side bikes, and that, you know, we might have to form a cabal to love the desert together and to sometimes love it from a distance and sometimes leave it the heck alone. To me, that was just so powerful, and just the sort of howling, loving nature of her rage in that book just made me want to meet her. And that was how I got acquainted with her work before any of this ever happened, before we, you know, a couple years before we talked about writing these books.
Amy, you had read the
Cowboys Are My Weakness.
Cowboys Are My Weakness. And the you said the first time you read it, you threw it across the room.
I did. I mean, Pam and I make a lot of confessions to one another in this book.
It's true.
But one of the big ones was, you know, halfway through the book, after praising Cowboys, which I have utmost praise for, but I didn't admit how I arrived at that praise, you know, a long time after I'd thrown the book against the wall, because in my 20s when I read it, I was so, like, frustrated with this woman that was doing all kinds of contortions to fit into this very masculine world. And of course, I didn't want to be that woman, and I was exactly that woman. And the only thing that helped me come back to it, which is, I think, an art that we've lost in this day and age, but I try to live by, and that is, when I react to something negatively, it's like, okay, what is that in me? Like, what am I not wanting to look at here? What am I projecting? What truth am I not owning to, you know, fessing up to here? And so I talk about how I took the book to therapy and talked to my therapist about it, and, you know, sort of as this mirror to all my own failed relationships, all of which seem to have almost like near fatal clashes or mishaps in the wilderness. And sort of like, so coming into my own story, my own relationship with the wilderness, and, you know, learning to trust my own instincts when I'm out there, be it fighting wildland fires, which I did, or being a park ranger, which I was, or being a climbing guide, which I also was, those kinds of, not as much now, but certainly when Pam and I were in our 20s and serving in these occupations and having these adventures, you know, we got hung up all the time, like that elk cow in the fence, on the ways we were supposed to be or that we couldn't be, the ways that we were excluded or put in danger. And so it was a huge book for me, right up there with Desert Solitaire, in that it really helped me to find my own way in the wilderness. Did you want us to read a little bit, or
please?
So I'm going to start with an excerpt from a letter written on May Day. When Ruby was young, I stole away for a ski on the mountain that presides over our mesa, just the dogs and me. I meant to follow a large open draw, but a herd of mostly pregnant elk cows had bedded down in my path. I skirted them by plunging into thick timber, and while I was in the forest, the sky clouded. The wind picked up and covered my track, and I got totally turned around. It grew late, and there wasn't a landmark to aim for, not even the slant of the sun. The dogs paced in circles. They stared at me, expectant, and I wished them for a guy, my father, a spouse, a bishop, a therapist, to show me the way out. The wish was a fleeting one, a kind of flash fiction, and an insane one, because what else do you call it when you hand over your agency, your fate, to another person? Men may not ask for directions, and that is a way I've been lost with them, but this is when I looked at Pablo and Ursa, my two crazy cow dogs, and said, go load up. They spun around and headed off in the last direction I would have chosen, but I skied after them, knowing they would obey my command to head for the car and launch themselves through the open hatchback. It was a race in the twilight, and sure enough, we found the vehicle. In dreams, there are not only monsters who want to strangle you. There are dogs who listen when you speak. Jung called them psychopomps, beings that if you are lost and ask for help, will lead you to God. The dogs listen in the woods, too. And they'll lead you to safety every time. If home proves to be a place you cannot breathe, the dogs will follow you when you leave that story. So will the velvety herds of elk cows and the forest, the elders and saplings and every tree in between. If the guns come forth, Pam, grab your pen and notebook, your bivy sack, your flint and steel. Climb above tree line on your side of the Great Divide, which is the only thing that should separate our nation during this pandemic. And even if they don't come, head up anyway. I'll meet you there with compass, envelopes, strings. We won't go alone. We'll have the dog, we'll have mentors, students, and daughters, and we'll have a few good men who are willing to walk with us, willing perhaps to play supporting characters for a while in the stories that need telling. Let's bring our ballots, too. Let's spell them out and tie them to the tails of ravens passing through. Let's climb the ridgelines with the letters we have written and cast them into the clear blue sky. Then let's toss that compass into some deep, icy ravine that never sees the light of day, because already we know exactly where we're headed. In fierce and loving sisterhood, Amy, P.S. You've proved to be another one of my favorite animals, and we've yet to meet in person.
And this is my next letter to Amy from May 7th. Is actually the last letter in the book. This morning on the dog walk, I realized the thing I am afraid of far more than I am afraid of dying a breathless COVID death, far more than being shot in the face by a camo-wearing MAGA dude, is becoming a person who says no to the world. Becoming a person who doesn't go out or hike out or speak out because prudence and my survival instinct tells me I should not. That would be the bad guys winning most of all. I can't say yes right now to a trek in Bhutan or a teaching in the wild world class on a raft trip down the Dolores or a march to protest women's access to contraception. But I can say yes to the tiny mountain ball cactus blooming near my clothesline. I can say yes to Lime Creek running over its banks too early, too quickly, but braiding itself elegantly and generously quenching my pasture. I can say yes to my students who I only see via Zoom these days, but who are still writing their stories like their lives depend on it. Because if we don't know by now that they do, we are definitely not paying attention. I can say yes to a horse named Ben, a thoroughbred paint cross, a big boy, 16'3" and broad as a boat, dark bay with a shoulder that looks like somebody threw a bucket of white paint at it. Ben needs a new home, and I need something to say yes to, so he will arrive on the 1st of June. I can say yes to these letters, which are sustaining beyond all reason, except the reason we keep sending them across these mountains that belong to everybody and nobody and mostly to themselves. But it cannot keep us from saying yes to the world. Whether this pandemic lasts for 1 year or 3 or a decade, we will emerge knowing far better what we need to survive. Even now I can see the pencil scratching through item after item, airplane travel, hipster coffee, Wilco concert, baseball. What remains? Air, water, horses, elk cows, ravens, and dogs. I have always put my faith in the concrete nouns of the world, but realize this list will have to include abstraction, community, trust, direct action, urgency, courage, sacrifice, love. We have not one single thing to lose by believing even now that we can build the world we want to live in, and we must, because time is short and inaction is death. Fighting for the earth and each other will be the only way to feel how alive we still are. So let's save the post office. Let's win the election. Let's win all the elections. Let's downshift and tap into the power I know you know we have, the strength we feel when we put our feet on hard dirt or words on these pages. Let's tend to the weary, the grieving, the hungry, to all those the system is rigged against. The earth is our ally. She always has been. Thank you for these letters, Amy. I hope there will be 1,000 more. I will walk now to the back of my property where the wetland is overflowing, breathe the clean air, and wait with a piece of string in this letter. Here I am now, my eyes trained on the ridgeline to the west. In everlasting sisterhood, Pam.
And that was Pam Houston and Amy Irvine talking with me about their new book, Airmail, Letters of Politics, Pandemic, and Place. This is Tracy Hales-Vass with Right on Four Corners on KSJE 90.9 FM in Farmington, New Mexico.